Chapter 19. Kaz Kalchi.
"He looks terrible," a devastated Caddy Bree said to Gallifrey when she and the paladin left the building housing Zack's vault. It could not be denied. Caddy Bree had been coming to him every few hours since the Avondrow had allowed it, and Zack's accelerating disease was plain to see. Now the entire left side of his chest was swollen and red, almost glowing red, and his mouth had stretched, reaching nearly from ear to ear, making him almost unrecognizable. He was failing, clearly, and he was changing. Gallifrey offered her a hand on the shoulder for support, but said nothing in reply.
"I thought your people had experience with this," Caddy Bree said. "Vast experience. Too much experience. And knew how to counteract it, to heal the phage. There is a reason we have increased our watch about the city in this time of the year," Gallifrey replied. "There is a reason why none but those patrols are outside of Caladay at this time. We have little experience with the Chaos Phage in the time of Twilight Autumn, because we do not engage the Sludai in this time, nor do they, so dependent upon magic themselves, press their attacks against us. Twilight Autumn is a time of peace because there is no magic, no illusions, no healing, no escape. Zacnaphane has to survive through the first few days of this sunset," she went on. "He must find it within himself to resist the final bites of the transformation until our magic returns. Perhaps the herbs and the ice will help to slow the progress. But it is his will that will carry him through. And if not, he will become a red slot. And your magic? You said the greatest of spells. We have nothing to save him then," Gallifrey grimly replied. "Once, so say the histories, we had a wizard who reversed the transformation, who wished the victim back to her previous life as Avondrow. But it cost the wizard greatly, and he was not able to cast that most powerful of magic spells ever again to the day of his death." That thought jarred Caddy Bree's thoughts. A wish spell? Who did she know who might cast such a legendary Dwyamer? No Harple, certainly. She thought of the host tower of the Arcane. If anyone there could perform such a great feat of magic, it would be Gronf Beanry. Could he? More importantly, would he? If the transformation is completed, Zacnaphane will be quickly and mercifully slain, Gallifrey said, jolting the woman from her thoughts. No, she argued. We will take him back to the south. We have powerful wizards. No, Gallifrey interrupted. You would have no way to get him back there in time for any wizard to perform such a reversal. And you would not allow it, Caddy Bree said. Gallifrey didn't confirm that, but Caddy Bree could see that the paladin was truly torn here. The Sludai were obviously mortal enemies of the Avondrow, and the thought of letting another of the beasts free was not one the paladin could easily digest. Red Slod were prolific procreators, so Gallifrey had told her. "Sunset is tomorrow," Gallifrey said. "Take heart. Zacnaphane is strong. Most would have succumbed long before now. Our magic will return soon, as will yours."
Caddy Bree nodded and took a deep and steadying breath, steeling herself against the grim possibility before her, because she saw the decline and doubted Zack would live another day.
"The battle is tomorrow," she said, hardly thinking. "Kaz Kalchi, yes, it is glorious. Have you ever fought in it?"
"Almost. But my journey and my piety took me to another place, one that I value greatly," Gallifrey explained.
Caddy Bree nodded. "Glorious and vicious, yes?" she asked.
"Few rules and the violence of a weaponless war, so I've heard." "What you have heard is true, though I doubt you can fully appreciate it until you have witnessed it. All of Caladay turns out for the four battles, each cheering for their burrow, each cheering for the tradition of this place we call home, and the determination that keeps us here alive."
"Why would you do that in this time?" Caddy Bree asked.
"If people are wounded, you have no magical healing, no potions even."
"If," the paladin echoed with a chuckle. "Many will be wounded, some terribly."
"Then why now?"
"Exactly because of that," Gallifrey said. "They risk great injury, even death, though that would be a rare thing,
for their belief in Caladay, for their loyalty to their neighbors, their willingness to serve with all. Because it is in this time that their wounds have meaning, their scars last, their risks are real. Don't you see? To fight when there is a priest standing ready shows little real courage. Caddy Bree nodded. It made sense, brutal though it seemed. We live in a dangerous place, Galathay told her. We have enemies. Giants, Slodi, vicious beasts, dragons, white worms, the land itself. There were 5 burrows when I was younger, but now there are 4, for the glacier took one. The heat of the river Caladay disappeared in the west, and Catasola was overwhelmed by Cadige, eaten house by house, her citizens scattered to the remaining burrows. Cadige's advance continues, and it is fostered, we are certain, by the Slodi. How is that possible? Galathay shrugged and shook her head. They prod Cadige, perhaps. They irritate him so he growls and his breath freezes and tilts the balance. Caddy Bree remembered her encounter with the glacier when she had called into the Plain of Fire, and she knew that there was within this vast river of ice some sentient, elemental power, perhaps not malignant, but nor was it moral in any way a mere human would understand. And because of these memories, Caddy Bree understood the gravity of Galathay's words, of the desire, the need for balance. This society, ancient and stable as it was, survived on the very edge of destruction solely because of where it existed. And if that went away, so did the society and home of the Avendrau. Caddy Bree had to put those notions aside, though, as Zacnaphane regained her attention and forced a heavy sigh from her. Zacnaphane is strong, Galathay said to comfort her one last time. The sunset is tomorrow. The 3 companions were awakened the next morning by roaring chants. They climbed from bed, wiped their eyes, grabbed their clothes, and went out into the abandoned common room. When she got outside, Caddy Bree came to believe that she and her 2 companions were the last people to wake in Shelobel, and the last to come out onto the street. Drow, Kurit, Eulutians, and Aurochs came down every side street onto the main lane, cheering, Biancorso victory! Biancorso victory! Champion! 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 The throng south of them parted, moving to the sides of the street, and down the lane came the Kazkalchi fighters, dressed in the same shift outfits with leg and arm ribbon wrappings that had been worn in the wine barrel fights, only blue-white in color. Their skin glistened, and Caddy Bree suspected that they were smeared with the mucus of the hagfish. The fighters walked past silently, some with fists raised, and the crowd filled in behind them, following them, cheering every step. I want to go see Zack, Jarl Axel remarked, speaking loudly so that his 2 friends, who were right beside him, might hear. But I don't want to miss this, whatever it is, Caddy Bree replied. And Treri pointed to the south, and the others noted Emelian and Elena coming their way. Kazkalchi, the 2 said, rushing up to them. This is the most important day of the year, Quista Kanze. Great holiday, Caddy Bree translated in her thoughts. She didn't have time to think any more than that, as their 2 escorts pulled them out into the lane, and they were swept along with the crowd. The cheering became singing, somber and prideful. Pepe Biancorso, Thalak Nadun. A braise jivin, Quista Tel. Quista Kanze, O Repusco Ton. Pepe Biancorso, Ultranak Nadun. Quella Frien Fair, Zres a Shelobel. Caddy Bree wished that she had her spells available, particularly one to comprehend the language better as the songs wound on. She understood enough of the main refrain to translate it on the 3rd singing, though. Hear, hear, White Bear, who march to war. Burn to victory before all eyes. This holiest day of twilight autumn. Hear, hear, White Bear, supreme army. For our home, our strength, O Shelobel. She couldn't keep up with the rest, but the words really didn't matter. The power of their rhythm, the joy and strength and determination of the singers, 10,000, perhaps 15,000, voices lifting as one was all she needed to know, and all she needed to be swept away in the moment. Even Jarl Axel seemed to have forgotten Zacnaphane for now.
The parade wound through the streets of Shellobel, ending at a stair of stones that reached to the top of the glacier, and beside them a wooden counterweight lift. The members of Biancorso trotted along the stairway, the cheers growing as they came into view of all the gathering crowd. Only after they crested the top and disappeared from sight did the borough folk begin following, all those who could climb the stairs doing so, the very young or very old or infirm being hoisted on the lift. Emilian and Elena led the companions up the stairs. "We were hoping to see Zack before the battles begin," Catty Bree said to the drow priestess, snapped momentarily from the pageantry.
"I was with him earlier," Elena said. "He fights valiantly."
"But he's losing," Catty Bree said, clearly interpreting her tone.
"He won't fend off the phage long enough for the return of the magic to heal him."
Elena didn't respond.
She didn't have to.
Catty Bree looked to her two companions and realized that neither Jarlaxle nor Entreri had heard the exchange. She decided not to tell them, not then. And so, as they ascended the stairs and came out atop the huge glacier, Catty Bree bore a great weight upon her shoulders, one that she was determined to suppress in this most important of holidays among the Avendrow. Daylight was meager. The sun below the line of mountains to her right, across the glacier, and the wind blew cold. She tucked the heavy robe tighter about her and pulled her fur hood lower. Emilian rushed to her side. "Here," he offered, holding a pair of gloves much like those Jarlaxle had gained from the clothier, only much less fancy in design. "These will help. It will be warmer in the Grand Colosseum, with all the people huddled about. But if you're still too cold with your thin southern blood, do speak up. We have other ways to help." Catty Bree nodded her thanks, and indeed, the gloves proved quite helpful and warm, surprisingly so since they were so thin. Even with that grim news regarding Zack pressing on her, it was hard for her not to be astounded when they followed the line across the ice sheet to the place Emilian had named the Grand Colosseum. It was carved into the ice, a depression whose nadir was a level field of ice perhaps 50 or 60 yards across and nearly twice that from end to end. Even more remarkable were the rows of elevated benches, vast seating stepped up from a few feet above the frozen field to many, many rows above. The scale of the place was beyond anything the companions had ever seen, something that became more evident as the viewing benches began filling, thousands and thousands of people from the four boroughs collecting in their allotted grandstands. Shellobel was on one of the longer sides, with Mona Chess across from them. The people of Bichette were seated to the right of Shellobel's stands, with the folk of Arden far across from them at the other end of the playing field. Catty Bree noted that a wall separated the Bichette grandstand from another, smaller one. No people were going there, cluing her in that this had been the seating for the folk of the borough that had been reclaimed by the expanding glacier. As a few people came out through tunnels onto the playing surface itself, the dimensions became clearer, including a wall of almost twice a drow's height encasing the rink. Tenders pulled sharp rakes, scratching the sheet of ice, while at the far ends, others were measuring and smoothing the edges of long, narrow windows centered on shorter walls, one on each end perhaps 20 feet wide and 5 high. Catty Bree couldn't make out much behind those openings, but at the base of the wall below each was a hole. "What comes out of that?" she asked Alina, who sat beside her. "Or goes in?"
"The gauze," she replied. "The ball. If you put the gauze in the window, the rectangle, of the enemy's side, and it remains, you gain a point. If it goes in deep enough to reach the slide that brings it down so that it comes out the hole at the bottom, it is 2 points. If you put it in the hole at the bottom, it is 2 points. And if you do that with enough force to bring it up to the window, it is 3 points.
You throw it in?
It doesn't matter how you get it in there. Kick it, throw it, place it. Throw in an enemy who is holding it. It doesn't matter.
That doesn't seem very difficult, Entreri remarked. Alina's smile widened.
The closer you get to your enemy's window, the fewer allies you will have defending you.
The enemies try to block you?
They try to hurt you, Alina corrected. To block an enemy would stop her from gaining points for her army. To hurt her gets her off the rink, and she cannot be replaced. The armies start with 25 soldiers each. Few Kazkalchi battles end with 50 still fighting.
After some chuckles, Jarlaxle asked, "What are the other rules?"
You cannot bite, you cannot kick the head of a fallen player, and you cannot gouge the eyes with a finger. A knuckle, yes, but not an extended finger. Oh, and you cannot grasp and twist the genitals of a man.
Elena laughed. I think the war was more fun before that rule was added, but I have heard that the damage was not always repairable.
That had the three companions exchanging dumbfounded looks, head shakes, and nervous laughter. What truly amazed them, however, was the continuing line of spectators coming to cheer on their respective burrows, and the sheer scope of this gathering. How many, Jarl Axel breathlessly asked when the place finally settled, most in their seats.
47,000, perhaps 50, Emelian answered. Almost all of Caladay.
To the three companions it was overwhelming, and more so when the four armies marched out from separate tunnels to stand for review before their fellow burrow-dwellers, Biancorso shining in their blue-white uniforms, across from Guard Real of Mona Chess in their regal purple, with the Boscale of Bichette in the woodland greens to one side, and the colorful yellow, red, and green patterns on the uniforms of the Arden Tivitris, the garden burrow. Most of the soldiers were drow, but several orcs and at least a dozen dwarves were also in the fight. No Eulutians, though, and Catti Bree made a mental note to later on ask Elena why the humans weren't involved. The cheering echoed across the glacier to the mountains and back, it seemed, and once again Catti Bree couldn't help but be caught up in the excitement of the moment. I wish Zack could see this, she heard Jarl Axel say to Intreri, and she felt herself deflate. Should she tell them? She decided against it. She would tell them later, after the battles, when they returned to Caladay and might go and see their dying friend. Telling them now would do nothing but ruin this magnificent display before them, as it was being ruined for her. As one, the crowd quieted, and the four armies turned toward the center of the rink and stood at attention, hands behind their backs. A tall woman in a huge flowing purple robe walked out to the very middle, climbed on a small wooden dais that had been dragged out before her, and raised her arms to the crowd. She is Mona Valrissa Jambule, Emelian quickly explained to the visitors. The current Mona of the temporal convocation.
The queen, Jarl Axel replied.
No, not that, Emelian quickly and vehemently corrected. Such an idea, it doesn't exist here. She is the governor, the mayor of the temporal convocation of representatives, serving until the next referendum. It is rumored that Galathay may aspire to the office. Perhaps if you choose to settle in Caladay, you will be asked for support from her. For all her annoyances, she would be a wonderful choice.
From the looks upon their faces, the concept he presented was obviously foreign to Jarl Axel and Intreri. But Catti Bree had some experience with elections from her time in Icewind Dale, where several of the 10 towns chose their leaders in such a manner. Certainly this was a matter the newcomers wanted to explore further, but this was not the time. As was clear when Mona Valrissa Jambule lifted her voice in song. The acoustics of this grand coliseum were truly amazing, for they heard her intonations clearly, and then it didn't matter as 50,000 joined in. It was more a chant than a song, Catti Bree soon realized, and more a matter of music than actual words, extended syllables and sounds. It was more feel than information, a beautiful chorus and harmony tugging at the spirit, not the mind, at the heart and soul. And yet for all its beauty, Catti Bree thought it a dirge, a funeral song for the long day, a greeting to the fast approaching night. It comforted her a bit, but soon she burst out in tears, fighting sobs, as she thought of Zachnephane, as this dirge became to her a tribute to his life well lived, a final tribute. She looked around, hoping not to draw attention to herself, but found that she was hardly alone here, that almost all the cheeks around her, even Jarl Axel's, were wet with tears. When it was done, there came one great roar, then a hushed and anticipatory silence. The Mona turned about dramatically and slowly on her dais, raising the tension, then lifted her arms suddenly above her head, right arm straight, left arm curving to meet it fingertip to fingertip. The tens of thousands went wild. Down on the rink, the soldiers of the four armies all pumped their fists and patted each other on the shoulder or the back. Catti Bree, Jarl Axel, and Intreri turned to their guides for some answer. She signaled that the nightfall will be without clouds, Emelian explained. The half moon waning, said an excited Elena. We will need no torches for the champion battle. Beyond Corso and Tivatris, Mona Valrissa Jambule declared. The two armies named walked out in formation to the center to confer with the Mona, while the armies of Bichette and Mona Chess went back into their tunnels. Azadonna, Entreri noted, pointing down at the woman. Vessi beside her, Jarl Axel said. While the teams conferred, more attendants rushed into view, some bearing one-wheeled contraptions, others with buckets and brushes. In short order, lines were drawn across the rink, dividing it into sections, and the rim of the window to Caddy Bree's right was painted blue, the one to the left painted in a red and yellow swirl. About a third of the way toward the center from each window were lines of the same color as the respective window, and near the center of the rink, two parallel black lines were painted about 10 yards apart. The armies aligned, leaving the Mona alone in the center, 12 each on the black line nearest the window painted in the other army's color, 8 more on the colored line, the remaining 5 behind them. The companions spotted Azudanna on the red-yellow line shouting instructions to her fellows, which included an orc, then found Vessi moving about with 4 others behind her, conferring near the window. The center guards are restricted within the middle third of the rink, between the lines showing the team colors, Emelian explained. Those in the second rank, the warriors, can go all the way back to our goal but cannot cross the line of their own color. Like Azudanna, Caddy Bree said. Yes, she cannot cross the Biancorso attack line. He pointed to the blue line drawn down to the right. Those in the back, the dashers like Vessi, can go wherever they wish, Elena added. About, the Mona ordered, and all 50 soldiers turned their backs to her. She nodded to a man sitting on the wall across from the Shelobel grandstand. He reached behind it and produced a sphere about as large as a head, a ball that appeared leathery. He hopped down and rushed forward, then rolled it the rest of the way to the Mona, who deftly scooped it up in her arms. Mona Valrissa Jambule then knelt upon the wooden dais and lifted what seemed to be a small disc off the center, leaving a hole upon which she placed the ball. She stood and bowed to each stand of fans, then turned to the ball again, kneeled and whispered something none could hear, and kissed the ball. She left the rink, climbing onto the wall beside the man who had sent her the sphere. Ah, the entire gathering began to chant, lifting their voices, stomping their feet, as Mona Valrissa Jambule slowly raised her hand to the sky. She dropped it as they dropped their chant, and there came a great thump, then a whoosh of air from below, a geyser of pressure that sent the ball flying high into the air. The armies spun about to face each other, all eyes lifting to locate the high-flying orb, which began its descent from 100 feet or more above the rink. The winds caught it in its fall, moving it toward the second rank of Tivatri's soldiers. Aggress, aggress, Emelian, Elena, and most of the Shelobel fans chanted, and the army did indeed. At the center of the rink, the two guard forces came together in a sudden and furious melee, punching, kicking, grappling. Azudanna led the second rank of Biancorso warriors through that melee, running hard on the somewhat slippery surface toward the blue line. A Tivatrice warrior caught the falling ball at about the same moment that Azudanna caught him with a flying body block, hurling him to the ice. She too went down, sliding hard and crossing the blue line, and so she had to come up fast, raise her hands in temporary surrender, and retreat with all speed back behind that line. The ball, meanwhile, went bouncing and sliding to the dashers of Tivatrice. They passed it all the way to the right side of the rink, then ran back to the left as Biancorso's defense set up to stop them. They never got near to the center, where one dasher threw it desperately to a guard before being buried in a tackle, and that guard, with nowhere to run, the opposite black line looming before him, just kicked the sphere as far as he could toward the Biancorso goal. Back and forth it went, the crowd cheering and gasping, roaring at wild brawls that erupted mostly in between the black lines at center rink. There was blood, lots of blood, and grunts of pain. The frenzy and fury of the melee racked Caddy Bree and the others, even Jarl Axel, who had grown up in Menzo Berenzon. The discordant reality of the sheer violence of these people, who sang such mellifluous songs, whose intricate and beautiful art was shown on every wall, every bridge, every pole in Shelobel,
and probably the other burros, who wore such colorful and creative outfits and danced with joy and spoke of love and friendship, staggered the woman. This was the fight in the wine barrel multiplied many times over. Bessie captured the first points, slipping past a Tivatrice defending warrior with a clever sliding maneuver that had him dropping to his knees below the warrior's attempted grab, then coming up beyond him and sprinting far ahead to catch a powerful flying kick of the bull from the orc Azudana had conferred with at the beginning of the battle. With no one else near him, Bessie easily outran the Tivatrice warrior and got alone to the window goal, where he dropped the ball down right before the hole and kicked it hard. He pulled it out from the window, gaining 3 points for Biancorso. The match never got closer than that. As Caddy Bree at last managed to look past the violence, she began to understand the flow of the battle, the quiet tactics playing out away from the ball. The violence and the fury ebbed as time wore on, with several, mostly Tivatrice, carried off the rink, and simple exhaustion turning many of the center rink brawls into melting grapples. Biancorso was clearly superior here, faster and stronger and more practiced in the scheme executions, and when the battle ended, they were declared winners with 13 points to Tivatrice's 2. As expected, Alina told the three, the gardeners have not won a battle in 3 years. Since the four orc brothers all decided that it was time for them to leave Khaz Khalchi behind. This is a young person's war, after all, and orcs do not live so long. An Avendrau soldier might fight for 40 years, but for an orc, 20 would be a long, long time of such service. Now come, I will show you to the banquet. You should eat before the next match. Beyond the grandstands on every side, long tables heaped with food and drink had been set out. There were even outhouses, far back from the food, fashioned of ice and with deep holes bored into the glacial mountain. Khaz Khalchi is the joy of twilight autumn, and the sunset of Quista Kanzei is our most solemn moment of reflection, a reminder of the good we have in the midst of harshness, Alina explained as they made their way. For 2 millennia, the Avendrau have lived here beside the blessing of the hot river Kaladay. We remember the strife of the times before that, the wandering, the hopelessness, the grief. This day, this war of Khaz Khalchi reminds us that our peace is earned by vigilance and by sacrifice, and that we must all be ever ready to do whatever is asked of us to preserve that which we have built. There is no Avendrau, Kurit, Orok, or Ulutian of Kaladay who would not die to save the city, or even to save another borough. When Kadij breathed upon Catasola, more people of the other four boroughs died trying to save the Catasolans than Catasolans themselves. For that, we are all proud and we are all one. Until you beat each other senseless in Khaz Khalchi,
Entreri remarked.
The pain is temporary, the glory eternal, Alina answered. When the brothers Norgu, the four orcs I spoke of, visit Shelobel or any of the burrows, they are hailed as heroes and will be spoken of as such until long after they are dead. Zaknafane would be a hero here, Jarl Axel said. And if Drizzt ever finds his way to the rink of Khaz Khalchi, with all that he has learned from Grandmaster Kane, he will dominate the ice, I don't doubt. Alina didn't know all those details, of course, but she stiffened at the remarks. Do not underestimate us, she warned. The armies you see in battle before you train for this fight throughout the year, every day. And think of these battles every waking moment, and in their very dreams. Jarl Axel bowed to her. I meant no offense, good lady, he said. None taken. Let us all pray that Zaknafane recovers from the phage, and so can try to earn his way to fight for Biancorso next Khaz Khalchi. Alina said it clearly and powerfully. But she glanced at Caddy Bree as she did, and the priestess of Mialiki noted her slight grimace. Again, Caddy Bree had to remind herself not to tell Entreri and Jarl Axel, not now. Let them enjoy the day. The next battle will be one of finesse against true power. Gardrial against Boscale, Alina told them as they made their way back to the grandstands after a fine meal. Many think Gardrial will win, and that is my hope. They may be too fast for the Timberfolk. So they are better. But you wish them to be victorious? Jarl Axel asked. Biancorso's warriors are fast enough to defeat Gardrial, I think. You witnessed Azudana in the first moments of the fight.
The scale is stronger across all three lines. They are lumberjacks and swing heavy axes all the day long, and so, too, swing heavy fists in Cascalchi. Biancorso is better suited to beat Guard Real, I think. That is how we won last year, and the teams have changed little. When they got back to their seats, they found that the blood had been cleaned and the lines and window trimmings repainted, now in the colors purple and forest green. The second match began exactly as the first had, with a burst of pressure from some mechanism below the rink, throwing the sphere high into the air. The battle played out along the lines Alina had predicted, except that Boscale prevailed, the decision coming down to a last charge where a Guard Real Curate Dasher leaped for the window, thinking to go right in with the ball. But at the very last moment, a Boscale warrior hit him broadside, deflecting him enough off target that, while he still managed to get the ball into the window, he didn't follow, cracking his chest and skull against the side rim and bouncing hard to the ice. That same warrior kept enough presence of mind and situation to reach into the window and pull forth the ga, stopping it from going in deep enough to catch the slide, preventing a tie. Caddybree found herself breathless as 15,000 Mona Chess onlookers groaned as one, and 6,000 Bichette fans roared in victory. Alina informed the friends that it was late afternoon when an exhausted and dispirited Guard Real lost to Tivatrice in the consolation battle. She and Emelian took the companions back to the banquet for dinner, and when they returned, they found a most unexpected surprise awaiting them. Their hosts had brought Zacnafane out to witness the final battle. Bearing him on a litter, which they had set beside the long bench seat reserved for the visitors to Caladay. The joy the three felt at the sight didn't hold, however, for Zack couldn't even respond to them with anything more than an eye blink and a half-hearted raise of his still-drow right arm. The left side of his torso and his right leg seemed almost twice their normal size, and much of his skin shone with a burning red hue. "We knew he would not find the strength to sit through all the battles in this long day," Alina whispered to the three a few moments later. "But we wanted him to see this last battle, to share this with you, at least, under the magic of Twilight Autumn. And it is magic, you will see." But Caddybree had a hard time accepting such claims, with her friend so clearly dying.